Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Okay, so this show is all about overlooked or misunderstood fields. And in 2023, I can think of no more misunderstood field than that of gender-affirming care. It is the boogeyman of every conservative talking head and your transphobic aunt's Facebook feed. There is so much misinformation floating around social media and YouTube, oftentimes masquerading as fact-based or presented by experts in good faith. And it's not. Oftentimes it's so much just junk. So I wanted to talk to an expert, like a real actual expert who's in the field doing the job every day in a hospital. Dr. Ashley Brandt is a board-certified OBGYN with a fellowship in gender-affirming surgery. She's a queer surgeon who uses her platform to help educate the public about gender-affirming care and remove the stigma around those who provide treatment, those who seek it, and those who love them. We have a broad, frank conversation about the myths and misconceptions of her work, the changes in technology, what it's like working with kids. Yes, we do talk about children and gender-affirming care, and where the field is going. Please note that this episode does contain information, but it should not be taken as medical advice or opinion. Here's Dr. Brandt. Dr. Ashley Brandt, welcome to Head on Fire. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So for folks that have not come across you on social media or don't know anything about you or what it is that you do, tell people a little bit about yourself.
So my name is Dr. Catherine Ashley Brandt. I am a queer fellowship-trained gender-affirming surgeon. I practice in a very rural area of Pennsylvania, actually. I'm married. I have a fantastic wife. And I was, like I said, I was one of the first fellowship-trained gender-affirming surgeon in the country. In Philadelphia, Mount Sinai had the first fellowship. That's in New York City, in case you all were wondering. So I perform gender-affirming surgery and in this rural area of Pennsylvania, and I'm hoping to kind of address a lot of issues that come up with that. So
how long have you been in the field?
About 6 years, actually.
Okay. So I mean, it sounds like not a long time, but like in fields like medicine and technology and other stuff, that can be light years. So how has, you know, how
it's
has care,
years.
Yeah, yeah, how has it all changed in just 6 years?
So I, you know, from fellowship, so I did my fellowship in 2018 to 2019. And at the time, you know, like gender-affirming surgery was very underground. It's been done for a long time. I mean, you're talking like the 30s, you know, it started over in Europe. And so it's been done for a long time, but not very publicly talked about. Even in medical school, it wasn't talked about. It wasn't until I was finishing my OBGYN residency, like 2017-ish, where this idea that like, hey, there's this fellowship that's going to happen at this hospital. Would you like to start this? I'm like, holy crap, this is perfect. This combines, you know, everything I wanted to do with the LGBT community and surgery, which I was really passionate about. And like, so just this idea that a fellowship was a thing was very, very new at the time. I mean, you're looking at like the last like 5 to 6 years. And the information, so even in fellowship, when we were studying, there was maybe 1, 2, 3 textbooks that we had, and maybe 20 papers that we can reference. And now this field has not naturally, I mean, you know, if you're not watching the news, you live under a rock, like it's being talked about in the media constantly. And so now we just have so much more information. So many more medical associations are addressing this, trying to develop new guidelines, trying to develop new fellowships that really address this care and are trying to standardize this care. So that's one of the ways I've seen it change.
Up front, I think it's important that we maybe define some terms so that everybody listening, if they're coming to this with fresh eyes, fresh ears, can, you know, kind of understand what everybody's saying. So from your perspective, from your, you know, inside baseball perspective, but that is the only sports analogy I will use the entire time because what terms should we be using? What terms are considered like outdated? And what terms should we completely avoid to describe the medical side of transition?
And just so you know, I don't have any other sports analogies here. So
yay!
You're safe. You're safe. So although I am playing softball after this podcast. So that's a very queer thing to do. You know, it's like I couldn't be any more stereotypical right now. But anyway, so you can have a podcast alone. I mean, I know you're a writer. I'm a writer. We can have a whole podcast alone discussing terminology, language, its evolution. And I think the really important thing to keep in mind, you know, is that language really evolves. Again, even in the few years after fellowship, even in fellowship, the language that our community uses has changed pretty significantly. When I was training, it used to be called sex reassignment surgery, sex change, and that is very outdated terminology and also just factually incorrect. I mean, you cannot change, you know, humans are not a type of organism that can change their sex, and that's not the nature of the surgery. So the terminology to use when you're talking about the surgery or surgical treatment is not sex change, it's not sex reassignment, it's gender-affirming surgery. It's to affirm your gender, to affirm your gender identity. And like really, all cosmetic surgery is like body-affirming at the end of the day. So it's really all designed to like be affirming with how you feel about your body.
I've said something similar a couple months ago where, you know, there are cisgender heterosexual men that develop what is it, gynecomastia?
Yep.
You know, breast tissue. And they, because that does not align with the version of maleness that they feel about themselves, they'll have it removed. Mm-hmm. And they don't think of that as gender affirming care, but from my perspective and my understanding of what gender affirming care, it absolutely is.
It 100% is. 100% is. Breast augmentation, you know, that is very, I mean, gender affirming and body affirming. So we've been doing gender affirming surgery for a long time. We just haven't been calling it that. And now you know, start to see it applied to transgender individuals, which is newer. Yeah. So getting to the terms, talking more about some of the terms you're asking. So, you know, and the other thing too, I want to point out, like one, I like to use the word queer to describe myself. I'm sort of figuring out my gender identity. I identify as a lesbian from a sexual orientation point of view. So like queer, typically similar to the word like gay, you know, these are terms that can have had negative connotations and have been used as like form of slurs. So for like members of the community that are familiar, that may be older on the podcast, like terms that we used to use, some of us may still use today. And I really like, in talking with people, like how I self-label, that's how I sort of expect people to label me back. If that makes sense to everybody. But for confusion, like GLAAD has a really, really good website for lists of terminology. The Center for Transgender Equality has a really good website. The thing with also using the term like transgender, I use the term lesbian and gay. So they're not nouns, they're adjectives. So when talking about, and I had this conversation with my 86-year-old grandmother over the weekend, who all of her friends have died. She is living with my parents. She watches the news, which is hilarious because it's like news and game shows, and she has the same reaction to both. There's a lot of yelling. And
did she have a big emotional reaction to Pat Sajak's departure from Wheel of Fortune this week?
Yes, she was very upset about that. But she is so adorable. And, you know, over the weekend, I was sort of grandma sitting because my parents were at a wedding. And bless her little heart, she said, you know, I have some questions to ask you about your work. I was like, okay, what is it, grandma? And she said, you know, what are the words I'm supposed to use? It's like, okay. And I said, you know, she's like, I'm not supposed to, I think, say like transgenders or things like that, am I? I said, no, it's transgender. It's an adjective. So it's like transgender woman, transgender, you know, like advocate, transgender person, transgender man. Like you don't add the ED to it. It's not transgendered. It's not transgenders, just transgender. And so she was like, okay, great, moved on, watched Jeopardy, and that was the end of the conversation. So I think it's like very interesting because, again, she hears these terms, like she's getting these terms from the news. And the fact that you have this 86-year-old woman that's like asking, you know, what am I supposed to use? I'm her only resource. And so she's like, great, those are the words I'm supposed to use. I'll use them, like moving on. The terms that are really outdated, which she didn't ask me about, transvestite is like no. Transsexual, no. Transsexual is kind of like equivalent to homosexual in our like sort of language. It was, you know, medical psychologic term that was replaced with, you know, gay and lesbian. Transsexual was replaced by transgender. It's just a more accurate description. Tranny, like, huge no-no. And other things that I think imply, you know, we talk about gender identity as being, you know, there's a debate about its binariness and sex being binary, gender being binary. And both of those things are not. It's not that simple. You know, using the term female to male or male to female are sort of outdated things to use as well, just because it implies that transitioning is linear and it's binary, and it's not. It's not linear, nor is it binary. So I think those are things to keep in mind.
What are the biggest myths? I mean, you tell somebody what it is that you do, and if somebody isn't already kind of inside of the conversation, what are the biggest myths? And I'm sure I couch that in saying, I realize that the entire rest of this podcast is going to be us delineating, you know, myths and misconceptions. So we could skip over this question completely, but like, are there just some big, like, what's that initial, you're talking to somebody, they don't already know, they're not already inside of the conversation. You tell somebody what you do. What's that first feedback, that first conversation?
Oh, there's two really big ones. One that actually probably may surprise you, which is, there's this idea that's gaining a little bit more traction of the fact that the reason why we have increased acceptance in like gender affirming care in the medical field and these adjustments to these guidelines is because, not because they're like rooted in evidence and that, you know, medicine does evolve as we get more information, we adjust our guidelines. Like, that is the whole premise of medicine and just general things in society, right? But that we're doing it because it makes money. And that's a thing that's gaining traction in some like more conservative circles, that we're doing it because it's lucrative and these guidelines are being changed because it makes a lot of money. Like, do hospitals and surgeons make money off of surgery? Like, yes, but it depends. It's like way more complicated than that. And, you know, I've had like a couple people slide into my DMs or anytime I do a reel just saying like, well, you're doing this, like you make a lot of money. First of all, I'm hospital employed and there's no like field for gender affirming surgery. There's no like one specialty that owns it. So I'm an OB-GYN by training and did a plastics fellowship. So like they pay me as an OB-GYN. So I do one or I do 1,000 of these and I don't get paid any differently. I see the same salary. I don't see any of that revenue. And like how surgeries are covered, how surgeries are paid for, and how hospitals and surgeons make money is, like I said, really complex. There's a lot of moving parts. And so it depends on like insurance coverage, like Medicaid versus commercial insurance. And so 50% of my cases are Medicaid. And kind of the joke in the medical community about Medicaid is that it covers everything, which is super great for the population that has it, but it reimburses hospitals the least. Like, that's how my hospital where I trained, Hahnemann Hospital, was shut down. It was like a 60-70% Medicaid and a for-profit hospital, which means we couldn't have gotten any rescue from state or federal because it doesn't rescue for-profit institutions, and it shut down. So I can, in fact, lose money on cases, which, excuse me, a lot of people don't think about. And so now if you're doing cash cases, I mean, surgeons can do that and charge whatever they want, but insurance covers these procedures. Insurance doesn't cover most cosmetic surgery. So a lot of surgeons try to use, because they can be very expensive surgeries for patients to pay out of pocket. So a lot of people, and insurance has been covering it for a while. It's been several years since insurance has been covering it. So that hasn't changed. And how we've gotten paid hasn't changed. So I think that that's a myth that I kind of want to like debunk. And when you like actually compare the cosmetic industry, which is the most, most people think it's the most lucrative industry in medicine, you know, and it makes a lot of money for hospitals for sure. But when you're looking at that, it makes like in 2021, $10 billion, just cosmetic surgery alone, not fillers, not Botox. The gender affirming, do you want to guess how much like gender affirming surgery made? Just, you can throw out a number.
$5.
$1 million.
$1 million. I am so out of, I could not even begin to guess. I am so out of the loop on what scale is.
Yeah,
I can tell you
it was close
veterinary
to 2 billion.
Healthcare. My
it
husband's
was close
a veterinarian.
To 2 billion. So like you have 10 billion in the cosmetic industry compared to like 1.9 or 2 billion. And like when you actually dig deep and look into what specialties drive the most revenue into hospitals, like general surgeons or gender-affirming surgeons, we're not even on that list.
Sure.
It's cardiovascular surgery, like CT surgery, interventional cardiology, neurosurgery, and orthopedic surgery are like the big money makers for the hospital. So yeah, like does surgery generate money? But like the FBI is calling me. Like, I mean, there are the amount of security required now for people doing what I do, how divisive it is, how controversial it is. Like most people are not willing to put their lives on the line. They're not willing to, like, there's no amount of money, right? Like, what's the price of your life? I mean, sure. That's kind of, and a lot of people that do these surgeries are plastic surgeons, urologists. Like you can make more money just sticking to what you do with far less postoperative management. I mean, the postoperative management for these cases for bottom surgery, like vaginoplasty or phalloplasty, are so complex. I mean, they're not just like, you know, pop some boobs in, you know, you go on your, you have a couple of post-op visits, you go on your merry way, or like do a BBL or do like a rhinoplasty. I mean, these require a lot, like it's a long recovery process and you have these patients for a long time. And so it's hard. And so a lot of surgeons aren't like, yeah, like let's do this because I'm making a crap ton of money. It's, you know, you face challenges, you face threats to your life, you have... again, and then just the complex nature of the surgery, it's just very complicated. And
why is the FBI calling you?
I mean, people, because I'm a gender affirming surgeon and rural PA. I'm in like the middle.
So people
of
are just calling the FBI saying, I am calling the FBI.
No. I mean, people like, I mean, it's just safety checks for a lot of us. I mean, you know, I know Florida issued, you know, a GLAD initial to national emergency for LGBT people. I mean, this is not a safe, like poor Shay Stragneo from, you know, the ACLU. I mean, these people that are really defending our rights. I mean, gender affirming centers that do pediatric and adolescent, I mean, they're getting bomb threats, like Boston mm-hmm. got a bomb threat. You know, the level of political violence has really escalated. And so we're on the radar for people to, you know, people that do the work that I do, you know, you have security check-ins to make sure we're safe. And, but it's pretty wild.
So I feel like what is missing from kind of the public's general perception of the work, of the process, of what it is that you do, of what it takes for somebody to go through this process, I feel like there's a lot missing from the conversation in the general public's knowledge base, like what happens before a person ever even undergoes surgery. So could you walk us through from the point someone is referred to you to the point they are recovered, how much time actually passes and what steps one has to go through to even receive care?
Yeah. So I will touch on this from the perspective of an adult, because obviously I'll pull back to like another misconception is that we're operating on children, which is definitely something we need to talk about. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to like frame this from the perspective of an adult patient, someone over the age of 18 comes to me for a surgical consult. So the process really can vary depending on where like a particular person is at with their like on their journey. Mm-hmm. So because I'm an OBGYN by trade, I still, you know, do that specialty as well. I sometimes patients will come to me just for like a routine like GYN visit, like a wellness check, and say like, hey, I'm interested in starting testosterone, or hey, I identify as, you know, a trans male. How can you help me in that process? And so for me, if I'm getting them at that point, you know, it's several conversations, referral. If they don't already have a therapist, they've talked to a therapist about how they're sort of feeling about their identity, I will send them to one of several centers that I work with, one of several therapy centers that I work with, I should specify. And, you know, we'll do like check-ins like every couple of months to sort of see where they're at. If they're over 18, again, if you have like, you know, other mental health conditions that are well controlled. So if you have, you know, the complex trauma is not play an issue. If you aren't like, you know, have well controlled like schizophrenia, you know, if you're not like psychotic or, you know, have a lot of other things that could impair this process, as long as you have other mental health conditions that are well controlled, you know, patients can start testosterone. So it depends on like when I see them. And depending on the surgery that they want. So in the example of this patient, you don't have to be on testosterone for a year to have surgery. But I do recommend, and the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, which is our sort of governing body that releases these standards of care. They just released one last year, and which is the first update in about 10 years. And so they compile evidence and standards that we follow. So they kind of don't recommend a specific amount of time that one person should be in therapy or discussing their identity before I start hormones or before I start or before I conduct surgery. I typically say, like, depending on how rigorous those sessions are, depending on a lot of other factors, it could be as quick as like 6 months, it could be a year or several years. And so it really is a very individualized approach about where is this person at mentally with life? Like, does this person have a good support system? Do they have a safe place to recover? You know, do they have the financial ability to care for themselves and buy postoperative supplies? So those are all factors that go into when a person could have surgery.
And I feel like it's important to stress that it's never just, I'm coming in, I'm handing you my credit card, let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go in the back and chop something off or add something or whatever. Because like that I feel like is the very crass, really awful version that people have in their head, like the wrong kind of people have in their heads. So like there's just this drive through where I'm coming and I'm just swiping my credit card and you're just doing stuff.
Yeah.
Like, and I think it's important to stress that like there's an entire therapeutic process that happens before.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, where people like because again, I'm also a surgeon. So some people may come to me that have already undergone that process. So they may have already been on testosterone or estrogen, and they may have already been with a mental health provider for years. They like everything is good. Their overall general health is good. Like all of their, you know, T's are crossed, their I's are dotted, and they come to me for a surgical consult about that stuff. That person is going to get surgery much more quickly. Like that can happen in a few like months, depending on my surgery schedule. So that's someone that at the time of the consult, I can more readily like schedule, but they're over the journey for both of those patients is the same. You still have to go through, and all of those things still have to be true. You know what I mean? Like they, again, you don't need to be on testosterone for top surgery, but like, say, you know, you want to buy vaginoplasty or breast augmentation, you need to be on estrogen for at least a year. So those patients are at least on hormones for a year. Most of them are talking to therapists for over that time. You know, for bottom surgeries, I have patients continue with therapy. I mean, bottom surgery is far more rigorous and it's a much more involved process on my end and their end. And the mental health team involvement is pretty significant before and after surgery. Social work is involved in those situations. And so the journey is where they connect with me on their journey can be different, but the path to get there is pretty standardized, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So because there is such an involved process, I doubt that there is nearly as much regret after the fact as some folks out there from a certain political perspective, like to try to make it out to be. But from your perspective, do you see a lot of regret? Do you see a lot of detransitioning at any phase in the transition process? I think from what I've read, most of the statistics that I've seen have said that that is pretty universally less than 1%. But is that indicative of your experience?
Yeah. So this is like a really great topic. It's a great question. So I personally haven't seen any regret in my own patient base from a surgical standpoint. It's not to say that it hasn't occurred and I don't know about it. It's not to say that it won't occur. I had one patient want to stop estrogen. They were older actually. So they were in their 60s. They did not want to continue it anymore. They just said like they're happy with the changes that they had and like, great. I mean, that's fine because there are some changes that are permanent. And so, but that person didn't.
And transition doesn't look the same for everybody.
Yeah. They're like, great. I'm old. I don't want to like potentially have a blood clot. I have like some great breast growth. You know, my wife and I aren't sexually active anymore. And so like, I'm good. And so that happens, you know, that's happened in my practice once, maybe twice. But, and you're right, the rate of regret is less than 1%. You'll see sometimes in the literature, like 0.2 to 3%. And the one thing, this may be a tongue twister, try and say this like five times fast. The only 0% statistic that exists in medicine is there is a 0% chance that there will be no complications, and there's a 0% chance that there will be no regret in any surgical field. Mm. There's just that number. You're never going to have a surgery that has a 0% complication rate. You're never going to have a surgery that has a 0% chance of regret.
But this is about as low as it gets.
It's pretty low. And when you look at like bariatric surgery is the field that is most analogous to ours. It's very involved. It involves a multidisciplinary team. You have similar psychosocial assessments. You need to meet certain milestones before you can quote unquote qualify for surgery. Some type of bariatric surgery is reversible, some is not. And when you look at that model, and I'll bring that up, like, you know, going back to the minors, I'll talk about that a little bit more. But like the rate of reversal in bariatric surgery is like 2%. The rate of overall regret when you're pulling all surgical subspecialties together is about 14%. And like even in the world of gynecology, so one thing that comes up a lot for patients that get tubal ligations under the age of 30, the rate for regret is between like 20 and 25%. Like that's super high. So like, so when you frame that next to the rate of regret in gender affirming surgery, like we're doing pretty good right now. And so, and that's again, because that process is so involved. I mean, if I wanted a breast augmentation, I walked into a cosmetic surgeon, like there is no psychosocial assessment. Like, you know, I have to be in good health, but there's no psychosocial, I mean, they can schedule my surgery. Like I'm free on this day. Like, does this align with their surgery schedule? Great. And like, it's a little bit easier in that scenario. And so it's just very fascinating. I mean, we need to care about regret. Like, I do not want people to misunderstand that I'm diminishing regret, because it's something that's very important, especially when you're talking about genital reconstruction, about vaginoplasty and phalloplasty. Like, those are big deals. And if you regret those, it's a long process. But
I did want to ask about this. So for those that are curious, or for those who are maybe considering some of these procedures for themselves, how much of this, if any of this, is reversible?
So we really say these are irreversible procedures. Now, there are some that are more quote unquote reversible than others. So a mastectomy, the mastectomies that we do, you know, the chest masculinizing surgery, it's similar and different from ones that are done for like breast cancer than desire reconstruction. So, I mean, we do mastectomies in general surgery and like breast oncology, and then do reconstruction afterwards. And so, you know, you can put implants in after, but it's not going to be the same. I mean, you're not going to have that same nipple sensation. It's going to look more like an oncologic reconstruction sort of situation. You know, and if people have had a breast augmentation, can you take out an implant? Absolutely. But that implant like stretches out the skin, stretches out that underlying tissue. And so you have to, have another surgery to correct that. So either like a breast lifts or like a resection of that skin tissue. As far as genital reconstruction, I mean, we really say it's not reversible. Can you create a phallus again? Yes. Can you create a vaginal canal again? Yes, but it will never be what it was. So if someone had a penis, underwent a vaginoplasty, and then desires to have a phallus again, it will never be what it was. And so this is why this is so critical, and the counseling is so critical. But I do also want to highlight there are other procedures that also can't be reversed. Like I said, in some bariatric surgery, you know, you can reverse the bypass or the Roux-en-Y bypass, but like you can't reverse a gastrectomy. So with a hip or knee replacement, I mean, anytime you're cutting out bone to do those surgeries, you're putting in prosthetics. And so if those prosthetics fail, you can't like put joints back in, you know, you're potentially wheelchair bound. And so those are other irreversible surgeries that, again, like when the idea of an irreversible procedure is not new. It's just one that gets really magnified in this field, unfortunately.
Speaking of in this field, and we've kind of hinted at it, but I do want to attack it head on. There are a lot of people who are very concerned right now. A lot of won't we think about the children rhetoric. So many people are concerned right now about minors undergoing any type of gender affirming care. Stay away from our kids. Let kids be kids, all of that. But most especially outraged at the idea that they might undergo permanent body modification before the age of consent. Only speaking from your perspective, only speaking as a medical doctor, from your perspective and understanding of the field, what does gender affirming care look like for minors right now? When do they begin? When could they begin treatment? And what does that treatment look like?
So I will speak to this from a surgical perspective, since any hormonal therapy that is done before I would see any minor surgically. So these are done at multidisciplinary centers that I work near. So I want to address this head on. I agree with you. Surgeons are not operating on children. And I want to be clear that the social, legal, and political definition of a child is different than my medical definition, different than actually the medical community's definition. So the medical definition of a child is someone that ranges from birth to puberty. Now, just to be clear, so puberty can occur. It's a range, and it differs in boys and girls. And so puberty can occur in girls from between the ages of 8 to 13 and 9 to 14 in boys. Now, again, these people are, quote, legally and socially still considered children. So I like to use the term minors to keep it a little bit clearer from that legal perspective. So I think when we're having discussions like this socially, it's what definition are we talking about? Are we talking about the medical definition? Or are we talking about the socio-legal political definition? And so surgeons are not performing surgery on people that are quote unquote children by our medical definition, not before people that undergo puberty. Again, and what is interesting, and I'm going to pull the field of bariatric surgery back into this. So the World Professional Association of Transgender Health came under fire because they kind of, quote unquote, removed the age requirements for surgery. I want to be clear that children and minors, I'll stick to that term. This requires significant multidisciplinary and parental support. People that are getting surgery that are minors need parental consent, first of all. They are seeing child developmental specialists. They are seeing this multidisciplinary team of people that determine each individual's emotional, cognitive, and psychosocial development into account. There are ways to screen for maturity. There's ways to screen for whether people can understand and obtain that kind of informed consent. So you have social workers, mental health providers, parents, and you also talk about regret and fertility preservation in these conversations. So this is stuff that's all done that's not talked about. And these are things that are handled and addressed long before they hit a surgeon's door for a surgical consultation. These are highly trained professionals that know how to assess that person's maturity before they would undergo this quote unquote irreversible procedure. And so I keep bringing bariatric surgery into this because bariatric surgery, again, aside from the multidisciplinary model that it requires, very similar to my model, of gender affirming surgery and care, there's no technical age limit for how low you can do bariatric surgery on someone. And that's a pretty big procedure that child's life and that minor's life is changed forever. When it was first performed, I think in California in 2004 on a 13-year-old, it caused an uproar. And so there's no age limit, but you're taking maturity into that. You're taking other conditions into account. And so this idea that we're operating on minors, that we're doing irreversible procedures on minors is not a new idea. There are surgeries done on minors all across the board that have been done on minors all across the board that require these very intense discussions. And we all take surgery on minors very seriously, regardless of our specialty, because you need to be careful about that. So I find it fascinating that it's gotten such attention when it's not this new concept in the field of gender affirming surgery. And part of the reason why it's very infuriating, and I think this is what, if the most important thing I think out of this podcast are these numbers, because this really puts this into perspective. So cosmetic surgery is being performed on minors. like across the country. I have data from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. This is accessible to the public. So you all can, if you Google American Society of Plastic Surgeons, you can find this data. Now, in 2020, it takes time to compile it. So 2020 is our most recent data we have. Between the ages of 13 and 19, 88,000 minors underwent cosmetic surgery.
And these are things like nose jobs, breast augmentations, that kind of thing.
Now, people may say, well, we need to compare apples to apples, not apples to oranges, because that's lumping all cosmetic surgery into it. So, okay, people want that. Here you go. So breast augmentations aren't really done under the age of 18. So if you look at people ages to 18 to 19, about 3,200 cisgender minors underwent breast augmentation, and about 4,700 underwent breast reduction. Do you want to guess how many trans individuals underwent top surgery?
Less than 100.
You're close. It's about 256, between 200 and 300 over like each year. So 2019, 2020, 2021. Is that number probably a little bit higher? You're probably closer to 400 if you were to pull that data for 2022. But like 300 patients, if you round up, 300 patients do 87,000 cosmetic cases. So if this argument is going to be about we shouldn't operate on minors, why are we singling out the transgender minors, those 300 transgender minors, and not looking at those 87,000 patients? So I find that like that is a thing that is very frustrating to me as a surgeon, is that, again, this idea of operating on a minor isn't new. We all take it very seriously. But these patients, these transgender patients, get mental health assessments. They're coming from these multidisciplinary centers. Those patients that are getting rhinoplasties or breast reductions, they're not having to go. I'm sure they can go through some psychotherapy if they need to, but they're not having to do all that legwork in the same way that the trans patients are. And so it's very interesting that we're very upset about this small number of patients.
I've worked in the juvenile justice system. I still know and am friends with a number of social workers. The fact that social workers are involved and could at any time rubber stamp any of it at all tells you, I mean, like they, social workers take their job very seriously. I have said for many years that there needs to be a TV show celebrating social work because it is a perilously misunderstood field. These folks are, you know, it is one of the most thankless jobs ever. But they take their job very seriously. And if there were ever a chance that a child was in any kind of danger or harm, it would not happen. It would not happen. And I do want to ask very specifically, because there's this idea. I got a comment just a couple of minutes ago on a video where it was like, well, all of this stuff can be done behind a parent's back. Oh, well, you know, if you're not careful, you could blink and your kid could accidentally fall into a gender affirming care clinic and come back with less parts or more parts or something like that. Like, is there ever actually a case where a legal guardian is not in the loop?
I mean, look, there are bad doctors and there's bad medicine practice like across. So I can never sit here and say with 100% certainty, I know there's nobody getting not doing the right thing. But I don't know where they'd be getting that. Like, no.
But in the system of medicine, I mean, because the thing is, like, anybody could get a sketchy boob job. It's like, well, I can go pay $5,000 for a boob job at a hospital, or I can go pay Jimmy in his van who says he can do it with $500 with some real great silicone. Like, those sketchy stuff exists, but like, in the system of medicine as it's set up and as it's supposed to work, is there ever a time when a child could go through the proper procedures and then somehow
you
the
can't do that?
Never know.
Yeah. You can't do that behind a parent's back. Like, there are, you know, STI screening, yes, like contraception, yes. But like, when you're talking about consent for surgery in this scenario or consent for these hormonal treatments, like, no. I mean, could it be done by a provider that it's like going way off the rails? Sure. But that person is way off the rails and is operating far outside of the acceptable standard of care. In the same way other people that are doing like these backyard boob jobs are practicing unethical medicine, and you're doing like, you know, abortions, like, you know, in Philadelphia where you had that surgeon doing things like, you know, not a registered abortion clinic. I mean, there are surgeons that can do bad things all the time. You know, Dr. Death is a great podcast, by the way. So you have like surgeons doing bad things, or you have providers doing bad things, but those are people that lose their license, or those are people that go to jail. Those are people that are held accountable by operating outside of the standards of medicine. And I think like where we are in this field, especially since everyone is so scared, where even though the guidelines have become, I can't say less restrictive, but more individualized, the new guidelines allow for a more individualized approach for this treatment, which makes sense because everyone's journey and gender identity is in fact individualized. But I think a lot of us have become more conservative in practice because a lot of us are very terrified of the repercussions. We really want to try and prevent regret. Regret is, again, very complicated. And so we're trying very hard to like make this a very well done field because so much of this is very serious. I mean, a lot of these are irreversible procedures. They're big deals. And so we treat them as such. So this nature that like people can come in this back door, like that's never going to happen at a center like mine. That's never going to happen at OHSC or Mount Sinai or, you know, maybe in the middle of nowhere at a clinic that like is not registered, and that provider will probably lose their license because it's illegal to do that.
So I want to discuss accessibility for a moment. So the trans community is one of the most disenfranchised communities in the United States, around the world. They are often underemployed. They have limited access to quality healthcare and are at greater risk for housing, financial, and other insecurities. These are very expensive surgeries, as you said, up at the top, that require a lot of hoops to be jumped through, a lot of time, a lot of access to mental health care, which is already something that is very difficult and very expensive for people to access, you know, require a lot of hoops before they can even begin this process. So what methods of access are available to them, and how are they improving?
Ooh, I think access and non-discrimination are really the two major things about our community that are still unresolved, unfortunately. I mentioned I live in Pennsylvania, and we currently, there is a Senate Bill 300 that's going through. I mean, we can still be discriminated against based on sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity. In like, yet we can do gender-affirming surgery in my state. So a lot of these issues that people don't know are still being debated, are still not even resolved on a national level. And it's like, I find that very interesting because housing, you know, housing, medical care, you know, safe, like having food, having a safe place to live, having shelter, having clothing, like these are all basic human rights. And I find it very interesting that insurance coverage for these surgeries has improved as far as it, you know, people can get hormones covered, they can get surgical procedures covered. Yet there are still these significant disparities between like with housing and financial stability. So your surgery can get paid for, but you don't have a safe place to recover. You don't have finances to get to and from your appointments. And so that's, it's really, really sad. And the only way to change that, again, is like through voting. It's through like really speaking up and trying to get some of these laws that would protect that accessibility to us. And a lot of patients will ask, what about home nursing? Like home nursing is really designed for wound checks. It's to, you know, help with cleaning catheters or emptying drains or emptying catheters and emptying drains. Really what patients need after that initial, you know, week, a lot of patients will have catheters and drains for a week, depending on the surgery. I mean, but really for 4 to 6 weeks or 4 to 8 weeks, I mean, you need someone to help you clean your house, to walk pets, to go grocery shopping, to, you know, you need to have that kind of money where you can take that amount of time off without and still pay your rent. And our healthcare system, our just general system has not addressed those things in a universal way, unfortunately. So accessibility is still a problem, and that is the thing that needs to improve.
What is that recovery period where, okay, so I'm post-op and then I'm able to go to the grocery store by myself without pain?
It depends on the surgery. So for top surgery, that recovery period is much quicker. So for a mastectomy or top surgery, you know, for my transmasculine individuals or my transgender men, those patients will, you know, have really be like kind of a, we joke, that's like you're a T-Rex for a week. You can't like lift your arms above your head. You can't, you know, or lift, you know, lift your arm above your shoulders. You have this really tight ACE wrap on, you have these drains. So you're kind of like really in your house, not lifting anything heavier than 10 pounds, like not walking pets. And then once that kind of comes off, those drains come out, you're still like, you can start to move your arms a little bit more, but you still can't lift anything heavy, really, I say, for 4 to 8 weeks. You can start walking around more. You can cook your meals at that point, but you can't, you know, work out for a good 4 to 8 weeks. You can't, like, I don't have my patients lift weights. I follow Aiden Dowling, and he's fantastic. First guy, trans man on Men's Health cover. He is, like, beautiful, beautiful chest, great results. And one of the things he said about post-op was he didn't lift, you know, weights until about eight weeks after. And so for vaginoplasty, however, that surgery is much more involved. I mean, it is a brutal surgery to recover from. It's messy. It's uncomfortable. You have drains, catheter, and packing for a week. You're bed bound for, I have patients on bed rest in the hospital for 3 days. Then they're like really laying low for a week. They're just getting up and moving around to use the toilet for a bowel movement, or like getting up, just walking around their room, and then like back in bed for that week. Once those drains and packing come out, then you start have to dilate. And each surgeon's dilation schedule can be different. So mine could be different from Mount Sinai or OHSU. There's no dilation schedule that's been proven to be better than the others. You just have to dilate. Because that new vaginal canal, it's similar to a piercing. Like you have to keep your, if you have your ears pierced, you have to keep a piercing in for a certain amount of time. Same thing with the new vaginal canal. You have to dilate so it doesn't close. But they're still, you know, you're not moving around. Like I don't have people leave their apartment or their house for the first 4 weeks. And so you have to find someone, like I said, to walk pets, to cook meals, to clean your house, to do your grocery shopping. And not everyone has that safe space to recover. They may or may not have a partner. They may or may not have family that are supportive. And so that is really problematic, because those are things that can directly impact outcome, like 100%. Because that, I mean, if you're having to move around, if you're having to grocery shop yourself, or you're having to walk your pet, I mean, you could have incisional breakdowns, you can have all that kind of stuff go wrong. And so that social financial support is so key to recovery.
How are things improving? Is the medicine improving, technology improving, access improving?
Yeah, I think the medicine is definitely improving. And I think the fact that you have these medical organizations really getting behind the field is really helpful. The AMA or American Medical Association just released a statement supporting care. The American College of OBGYN, you know, the American Society of Plastic Surgery. I mean, you have these big organizations, aside from WPATH, you know, really stepping up and, you know, defending the access, defending the need. And there is more and more research. I mean, surgical treatments are getting better. There are fellowships now. So we are working towards standardizing the care in a way where you just don't have a surgeon do like a weekend training course and then go do the surgery. So we are looking to really develop new surgical techniques to standardize how we're conducting the surgery and just improving outcomes in that way.
I want to ask here at the end, because I follow a lot of trans folks on social media, and what I always love about them sharing their own experience going through transition are all of the little things that they didn't realize were going to become very important to them throughout the process, like how much time they spent picking out their nipples. Or having a conversation about the placement of nipples, like I did, like that kind of thing. What are things that folks who may be going through these procedures themselves one day, possibly if they're considering it, or for folks who love somebody who might be going through these procedures, what are some of the things that people don't realize might actually be very important to them? Until they get there.
That's a tough question. I always say, the thing that always trips people up is they didn't know, like for top surgery, for example, like that ACE wrap sucks. And like, it's very hard to know how tight that is and how like annoying that first week is and how uncomfortable those drains are until you go through it. Mm-hmm. So I always ask people, what is the hardest thing you've done in your life? Like, have you run a marathon? Were you living overseas for a period of time? Like, what is the hardest thing that you've done? So take that. And granted, like, if you climbed Mount Everest, that's actually probably harder than recovery from surgery. But take the hardest thing that you've done and magnify that by like 10, you know, for like a vaginoplasty, for example. It's like the little things you don't realize, like just the general discomfort of the whole process. And it's a very emotional process for a lot of people. And so what I will tell people not to do is please do not come to your office, your surgeon's office, whether it's me or someone else, with pictures of vulvas. Please do not do that. We have books of like all vulvas come in different shapes and forms. There is no one right vulva, but I've had patients print out vulvas from porn where I'm just like, this isn't even this is like not real in any worlds. Like, I am not making Barbie doll vaginas. Like, this is not Barbie. Vulvas are not like the goal. I make the vulva and the vaginal canal to fit like your body type. And so I think that
people
that's
aren't
like
doing this with penises. They're not like bringing you like, hello,
I don't do phalloplasties.
Okay.
But maybe, I mean, if I did, maybe I'd get that. You'd have to ask the team at OHSU. But
I was going
to
say, are people bringing in like fruit or vegetables and saying, okay, I would like between this banana and this cucumber?
No, but actually that would be pretty helpful. But I also say that I make vaginal canals to fit your body, not the penises that potentially would go in them. So
amazing.
Yeah. Like, it's a very like feminist approach. Like, I'm making it for your body, your anatomy. You know, for people that were assigned female at birth, they have to figure it out with their partner, you know, most. Yeah. And so like there are anatomic things, you know, like the average vaginal length is 4 to 6 inches. And so that's like
listen,
the metric.
Cis
that you
women,
go through.
Listen, yeah. Cis women, there's a lot of conversation out there and people don't know this. People think they're doing it wrong. Listen to that part again.
4 to 6 inches, yeah. But the average penile length has increased now. I saw in one of the recent medical articles, like now the average penis length is like up from like 5+ inches to like 6. So,
hey.
Yay. But so that's one of the things. Like, please do not bring a vulva picture or ask me to like fit cucumbers in. Each individual's body is different, and there are anatomic markers that I use and will achieve.
What is something that nobody ever asks you about your field that you wish they did? Like the one piece that you're just like, oh, you're just asking the wrong question. Or I always forget. I wish that somebody knew this.
Like about what I do specifically or about...
Yeah, all of it. Yes. What's something that that people are just missing in the conversation? They're asking all the wrong questions. This is really the question you should be asking.
Who am I doing this for?
Hmm.
Who am I doing this for?
That's a good one. And I think that's missed in a lot of fields.
Yeah.
A lot of fields.
With this surgery, and as you said, in all fields, is this surgery has to be done for you, mm-hmm. for you to feel aligned with your body, for you to feel like completely one and happy with who you are. And that's all cosmetic surgery. That's all like just general, like surgery in general. I mean, for hysterectomy, like, is this a decision that I'm willing to make? Because that's an emotional decision for many people assigned female at birth, is losing that like idea of reproductive capacity. When you're talking about, you know, gender affirming surgery or plastic surgery, like, who am I doing this for? Am I doing this for like, do I want bigger breasts like in cis world? Like, do I want bigger breasts because my partner wants me to have bigger breasts? Do I want a labiaplasty? I had a labiaplasty consult an AFAB patient, cisgender woman, and she said, these bother me. These bother me because they get pulled in during sex. All of my partners that I've had said, like, it looks great. They're happy. They don't think I should change it. But if it bothers you, then you have to do what you have to do. And I think that is the approach that surgeons, that we all need to take as a community, that patients need to take. Like, I'm doing this for myself and nobody else. Society may or may not treat me differently. My partner may or may not feel differently. But I am doing this for me because this is who I am.
Well, thank you so much for being here and thank you for your time. You have a fantastic social media presence, which is educational, informative, fun. Takes a lot of fear out of it.
Sidebar about how to beef it up a little bit, but that's a separate conversation offline.
For folks that do want to follow you on social media, where can they do that?
So it's Dr. Cash Philly on Instagram. So it's actually spelled differently. I actually have to look up my Instagram handle because I have periods in weird spots, which is embarrassing.
And don't worry, I will, if you just go to find the social media post where on the day that this premieres, I will have tagged you. So
there
people
we
can
go.
Absolutely go
there
easily
we go.
Find you.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Brandt, thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire. This has been such an eye-opening and an important discussion. I really hope that this helps kind of spark further conversation and maybe take some of the fear out of some of these topics for some people and helps open the door for people to have honest conversations about these in their own lives. So thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you so much for having me. I think this is like such an important topic that we don't have the right people speaking up all the time. And, you know, it's something that we need to address and really kind of squash a lot of the misinformation that's circulating. So I appreciate you wanting to talk about this.
Well, that's going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks once again to Dr. Ashley Brandt. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Please consider sharing it with your friends on social media. Word of mouth is the best and easiest and freest way to help spread the word. Or you could also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners like you. If you hate the ads at the beginning and end of each episode, consider joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and little freebies along the way. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Or if you'd like to connect with me on social media, I'm at headonfirepod on TikTok and Instagram and Twitter and whatever new social media they're going to roll out this week. Thanks so much for tuning in and downloading the show. Thanks so much for being here. I'm going to go. But remember, this was not medical advice or opinion, so don't sue me. Be well.